Black Cats Run Podcast. I'm Tristan Black Ingersoll. This is Black Cats Run. Are there pieces of training, performance, and improvement that we can infer from the patterns that we see that exist outside of the information that is consistently presented to us? How do we explore these? How do we infer these? How do we justify these? And what conclusions and changes to practice can we apply as a result? Let's get into today's episode. People who are successful because they have been put in positions to succeed. Whether that is athletically, academically, artistically, financially, economically, however you want to frame or take cross-sections or samples out of our culture, overwhelmingly, people who are successful are people who have been put in positions to succeed. Now, the paradox that obfuscates this is that just because people are put in the right situation doesn't mean that they will necessarily, quote-unquote, succeed. Part of that is because our standards for success include high visibility and, you know, decile of the decile level of status within a particular area. Another obfuscation is that people regularly lie blatantly about what their success looks like. Whether there is something going on psychologically where people actually believe fundamentally in the structures of the narratives and the stories they tell about their pathway to where they're at, or whether they genuinely believe that it is not an issue for them to just create whatever narrative they want, we see that too. As a teacher, something that I often encounter is an attitude in education that in order for students to be successful, we need to essentially make their environment as adverse as possible, and that the responsibility of the teacher is to design the obstacle course, to protect the obstacle course, and that people won't succeed unless they encounter adversity. And this creates this really bitter irony, is that we perpetuate a belief that success comes from encountering a greater level of adversity, as if it somehow remolds you into this success entity. And the irony is that the opposite is true. And so whether it's in schools, whether it's in areas of employment, whether it's in athletics, whether it's in our interpersonal lives, right, whether it's with families and friends, overwhelmingly, the things that we do make it difficult for people to succeed because we have created this fundamental myth of what success looks like. So something that I have been mulling over and thinking about is this idea of what limits performance and success? And are there things beyond the conventional explanations? Now, if you're a long-term listener of the podcast, you can probably infer that the answer to this is likely going to be, at least in my opinion, in terms of what I'm going to attempt to share here, the answer to this is, I believe, yes. But I think it is not something that I necessarily feel that I know definitively what the answer is. And I think perhaps even more so than usual, I want to make clear that I'm trying to explore the possibilities of an idea through this medium here. And I want to talk about the idea of thresholds, the idea of whether or not we actually meaningfully have identified and determined what these thresholds are, and then to try to go a little bit further than that if we can. I said in the introduction that people who succeed succeed because they are in positions to be successful. And I also said that I think by and large, people don't seem to recognize that. And I experience as a coach and as an educator this on a regular basis, that the question is always asked, how come this isn't rigorous enough? Where is the adversity, right? And then a lot of it is this, well, back in my day, it was like this. And it would be rude to say to people and ask them the question, well, what about you? Are you successful? Because success is such a desirable trait in American society, and everybody wants to feel that they're successful. And I think, understandably, many of us would not want to think that we had left things or missed opportunities, you know, because you don't have the opportunity to go back and reset. And as you get further into life, of course, it's more difficult to try to start something from fresh. But it's hard to start something fresh anyway. So when we think about this concept of performance, a lot of times people say, okay, well, the races are hard, and if you go a certain point, it just becomes so challenging and you can't keep going. And I've tried to establish on the podcast in the past my belief, which is that I think at the genesis of the concept of training, the idea is, well, let's do what we can do to get to that outer boundary, right? That perception of, and engage with that boundary. And then we're going to somehow improve our ability to handle it, which is the idea that the best coach or the best self-directed athlete is going to create systems of adversity, and that there's some inherent value to that adversity. And there's all kinds of cultural ways in which we've, you know, validated this, but essentially no pain, no gain is an excellent rationalization to void ourselves of responsibility for the circumstances that limit people. Because it's like, if you find a challenge, now we say, well, that's great. That's actually exactly what you need, is you need it to be difficult, because that's where all the great outcomes come from. And if anything, making it easier would just be a disservice. And I think this is a fallacy. I think it is shockingly convenient. And I think it's something that we reinforce. You know, but people aren't succeeding because it's hard. They're succeeding because it's easy. I've talked about how the person who wins a race, they don't win because it's hard. For them, they're winning because for them it's easiest. If it was easier for somebody else, if the ease of the velocity of that competition performance was easier for somebody else, then that person would be winning. Now, there's exceptions, right? People might crash, or people might sustain an injury, or right, there's these other things. But all else being equal, setting aside those, you know, outlier things, these things that may occur, but, you know, ideally are not going to be things that we want to have determining the outcomes of competitions, determining, you know, where we fall in terms of that performance spectrum. The reality is that the person who finishes first because it's easiest. So whatever their process of preparation, sometimes it might appear like the lack of thereof, right? Whatever that is, it's putting themselves into positions to succeed, right? Well, if you take that back a step, to get to that point in the first place, there must have also been a previous level of getting into a state where it is possible to succeed, right? And you can go back and back and back and back. Success is a product of success environments, okay? Success is not a product of adversity, right? People are, this is not, you know, the Dark Knight Rises is a work of fiction, okay? Successful people are successful because it was basically easier for that to happen than anything else. But we want to glorify this alternative narrative. So I ran the Millinocket Marathon this fall, and one of the things that I started thinking about as I got to the last maybe 5 miles, and you know, my legs are totally dead and they're turning to wood, is I wasn't running this necessarily at my absolute outer boundary effort per se. And nonetheless, right, I'm entering failure as I get to the point of, in hindsight, I would say probably the longest run that I had really done in the 4 or 5 months preceding this was about 21 and a half miles. And at about 21 to 22 miles, that's when the wheels really started to come off. And it wasn't an aerobic issue. It wasn't an energy issue in terms of metabolic issue, in terms of not eating food or whatever. Just my leg muscles just failed, right? And then for the next several days, it's like you can't really go up and down the stairs. And of course, anybody who's done these kinds of events of this length, you know, knows what I'm talking about. And I think some cases people can experience this in shorter races too. I've never experienced it really in anything shorter than a marathon. Maybe some sort of, whether you want to call it soreness or stiffness or sort of muscular, like deadening, I guess, after sometimes doing a half marathon, right? But usually something of pretty significant length. And, you know, it begs the question of why is it that we're reaching this point of failure? Like, what is driving that? What is causing that? What is determinant in terms of that failure? Because now, one way we might explain this is we might say that, you know, your VO2 max isn't high enough. Or you might say that your glycogen is depleted. Or you might say that your lactate threshold is not high enough. Now, some of these things I think are more valid as benchmarks of fitness, performance, more determinant in terms of performance than others. I've expressed my skepticism as to the significance of, you know, VO2 max. I don't think VO2 max is really, at the end of the day, much different than just saying how fast can you run a mile, you know, because VO2 max doesn't even necessarily predict velocity. VO2 max kind of just predicts VO2 max, where something like lactate threshold can predict performance. But in this case, doing this marathon, I wasn't setting out to run it at my absolute best. I will say I ended up feeling that the race was pretty challenging. There is a 2-lap course, and the first 10 kilometers are pretty much all uphill on the Golden Road, which was just completely packed, you know, scrambling snow, just up and up and up and up, right? And had to hit that twice, and that was very hard. So I'm not saying that I'm being casual. I think you run 26 miles, and this is kind of my point. You run 26 miles, chances are you're going to get pretty tired. So, but if you apply that logic of those preceding paradigms, this idea of like fractional utilization or, you know, glycogen sparing intensity, in theory, you should just go along and you shouldn't get fatigued, right? And that's because we determine fatigue to be the result of certain factors. But what I want to propose and what I've been thinking about is, well, isn't it interesting that people seem to reach this point of failure in the marathon all the kind of around the 20-mile mark, plus or minus 2 miles? So if it was a metabolic issue, well, that would happen as a function of time, right? that presumably people doing the marathon, right, are all running at a high level of exertion, right? Because they're racing there. And if they could go faster, they generally would want to do that. So most of us people out there stupid enough to sign up for these things are going to be, right, working at that level. So if glycogen depletion, for example, occurs around 90 minutes to 2 hours, let's say, then everybody should be reaching that point of muscular failure at 90 minutes to 2 hours. Well, that's clearly not the case, okay? Because if that was true, you would have most people, right, hitting failure, you know, pretty close to 15 miles or earlier. And instead, what we see is that there's a distribution, I think, plus or minus 20 miles. And I would say the 20-mile mark is sort of stereotypically something that's talked about as being the turn point, that the last 10 kilometers are really the hardest part. Now, it's also the case that the sort of most common longest run that people do leading to a marathon is 20-mile run. And there's a perception that if you train longer than 20 miles, that that's too much and that's overreaching. Now, we also have to take in consideration, again, anecdotal evidence, people self-reporting about training, whether that's people under-reporting, people misrepresenting, people misremembering, people just saying things because they want to feel like they're fitting in. There's a lot of factors when we look at that kind of evidence that are problematic. But again, by and large, I think this is pretty true. When I ran the Marine Corps Marathon 2 years ago in D.C., there's a part of the course around, you know, the 21 to 22 mile mark, 20 to 22 mile mark, excuse me. But it's just this like, you know, okay, let's add some more on the course. And you just go out and then you do like a hairpin turn and you come back. And that was like, it was ungodly what was happening there. There were people weaving back and forth and staggering. There were people lying in the road. You know, there were paramedics all over the place. And, you know, I would say that it's not as though these are people who I would say were underprepared. I think I did that one in like around 306 or 308 or something like that. And, you know, so pretty much I'm very close to that 3 hour cutoff. So the vast majority of people up the road are, for all intents and purposes, sub 3 hour marathon runners, right? So people who can run 7 minute pace or under 7 minute pace for a marathon, right? So strong, respectable running. And, well, you would think, therefore, like, good, prepared, right, runners. Unbelievable. Okay, like most bizarre dystopic thing. Because usually, right, the course continues, but you had this weird opportunity to just sort of go out and then rubber pan back and continue on the course. And so you had this incredible snapshot. So why are people hitting the wall all around this same distance marker? Okay, it doesn't really add up with these other kinds of explanations. So what is true is that if you have a given mass and you want to move that fixed distance, you want to take 70 kilograms and you want to move it 100 feet, okay? If you move it 100 feet, it doesn't matter how quickly or slowly you move that, it's going to require the same amount of energy for that 70 kilograms to cover 100 feet. It doesn't take less energy to cover the 100 feet if you do it faster because it takes less time, and it doesn't take less energy to do it if you do it slower because it takes because your velocity is slower. If you take more time and your velocity is slower, you're doing the same amount of work, right? So in kilojoules, it takes the same amount of work to move that. Now, there's some variation in running economy. People who are a little bit slower probably tend to have worse running economy. People who are a little bit faster tend to have better running economy. And I think that accounts for this variation. But, you know, by and large, we're seeing a lot of people blowing up in this distance around the 20-mile mark. Okay. And it's notoriously true of the marathon. And people get tired. And I think certainly some people are going to be hitting the wall in that same way in shorter distances, but it's not nearly as recognized as we see in the marathon, right? And, you know, in longer distance races, like cycling, you know, we see this too, right? And other sports, endurance sports, you know, you're going to have this too. And this is my conceit, is that this can happen at any point, right? And I'm saying that this, I don't think this is metabolic. I don't think it has something to do with fractional utilization of peak force production. I think that it is a kilojoule threshold. I think it is a point of mechanical, basically, failure, okay, where you have a threshold of kilojoules that you can put out, and it is movement specific, right? And I think that when you start to take this concept, and one way to sort of test these concepts in theory, right, in terms of the thought experiment, because nobody pays me grant money to run experiments and test these things, right? So we use the playground, right, that we're given, which is our ability to kind of look stuff up and use, again, the historical approach, right, of let's look at what the evidence is, let's look at what the evidence applies, let's plug in our theories into different evidence situations and see, okay, does this sort of seem to tie things together? And can we, by the power of that inference and implication, start to propose a possible model? And I know that for a lot of people, that you're going to feel that that's an invalid approach. But that's because sports has been traditionally taken over by exercise physiology and by biology and exercise science, and that they have this particular concept of method of inquiry. The historical method of inquiry is a completely valid mode of inquiry, okay? And it's completely validated. It's a legitimate academic discipline. It's just not what's commonly applied. And so I'm acknowledging that for some people, you might be inclined to be circumspect, right? And maybe a little in feeling a little incredulity around some of these claims. And I think that's good. I think it's good to, you know, wonder about the legitimacy of this stuff. But I encourage you to maybe think a little bit more openly about that and be a little bit more willing to at least give some consideration to these possibilities. But the idea is, the way that this threshold works is that based on your recent training history within a given mechanical mode of movement, so running would be a movement, Nordic skiing is a movement, swimming is a movement, swimming a specific stroke, right, is different from swimming a different stroke. Cycling is a movement. Cycling on a time trial bike versus in a road bike position, right? Might be, right? So you get into a certain kind of movement differential. And within that domain, you have a threshold of kilojoules that you can produce before you reach fatigue. And that that point, you now have to back off, reduce what you're doing, or to the point of maybe doing nothing for X amount of time, and then after X amount of time goes by, you will have recuperated, right? And you will be able to go out and now do work up to that threshold again. Okay, now in the scale of a race, like a marathon, let's say that you only run 20 miles in training as your longest effort, okay? Well, that is perhaps in a, now there's a layers to this, right? Because you can also have more or less kilojoules produced not just through a single session, but cumulatively, a density of kilojoules, depending on how much you do, right? But the key thing to start with here is that the kilojoule threshold is something that we're saying is tied to your distance. Okay, it's tied to distance. And it can't be tied to time, because if it was tied to time, then there wouldn't be such a close clustering around the 20-mile mark as this point where the vast majority of runners, probably 80, it seems like 80 to 90% of runners are hitting the wall, right? And I would say the other percentage are either getting through to later or feeling great the whole way, or the other percentage are just like shutting down way earlier because of a significantly lesser level of preparation. But I think a lot of people who do a marathon are going to try to get up to 18 miles to 22 miles as a long run. And I think a lot of times this is where people are blowing up. Now, I don't think the implication of this is that you need to go out and necessarily run 26 miles, but I think you need to have a kilojoule threshold for 26 miles if you really want to run your best possible marathon and if you don't want to hit the wall. So at shorter distances, it's easier based on what we see for people to get their kilojoule threshold up, right? It's relatively easy for more serious runners, you know, to find the time, even if you have a job and other lifestyle commitments. It's still pretty easy to go out and run 50 miles a week, right? It's pretty easy to go out and run 50 miles a week. So you're not really going to see people hitting the wall running 5K, 10K, half marathon type distances, 15 kilometers, 10 miles, whatever. But with people who run much less, people who have much less preparation, well, now they're people who might struggle with that. They might blow up. Some people are going to hit the wall trying to run for 3 miles, trying to run 5,000 meters, right? But we tend to not really think about those people oftentimes just because we tend to dismiss them out of hand as not representative, that they're too new or too uninitiated. And I'm not saying this because I have some gatekeeping issue around who's a runner and who isn't a runner. Anybody can be a runner. If my cat wants to identify as a marathon runner, they can. I personally don't identify as a marathon runner. It's not important to me. So that's not what we're talking about here in terms of who's labeled. We're talking about who's labeled and just in terms of like when we're thinking about the diversity of experience and these sort of causal factors that might be there, the fact that we choose to leave certain people out means that we're leaving certain information out, and that is going to limit our ability to reach the most accurate possible understanding of what is causing this stuff to play out. So, you know, if you're now the other thing here to throw out here before we get too carried away is that I'm not saying that the implication is that, you know, the only way to improve your kilojoule threshold is to do just longer runs. I do think that that contributes to that, but I don't think that's the only factor per se. So we don't want to oversimplify this into this understanding of, okay, I guess I need to run 26 mile long runs if I want to do a marathon, and I just don't want to do that. That sounds really tiring. That's going to take too much time. That's not what we're saying per se. What you are saying is whatever it is that can induce an increase in that kilojoule threshold, that's something that needs to be happening, okay? But when you're doing long runs, for example, you can observe this effect where you can increase, right, your distance, right, relatively quickly, but you're not going to necessarily be seeing a measured increase in, say, a lactate threshold as that distance is increasing. You're not necessarily going to be seeing an increase in VO2 max. And as somebody who has, you know, gone through periods many times over the years of consistently doing long runs to getting away from doing long runs, and I would say every year I probably have a phase of the year where I'm doing long runs and then a phase of the year where I'm not doing long runs. And a lot of times that's the time of the year where I'm trying to make more time to ride the bike or make sure I have the energy to ride the bike and I'm not committing to doing, you know, a 15 or a 20 or a 25 mile run necessarily every weekend. And then when I start trying to bring back long runs, I find that, you know, just going out and running 12 miles is like terrible, right? And then, you know, after 5 or 6 weeks, now I'm running 20 miles, 22 miles, right, is when it starts to feel hard. And basically at about 17 miles, I'm now starting to feel as a total breeze, right? And then if I get away from that for long enough, then I lose that ease. And I think what that is that's that mechanical endurance, right? It's my capacity to sustain or to execute or to produce a certain number of kilojoules, okay, over that distance, which in a sense, right, is just a function of how long you're going, right? But I think it's important to understand the concept of kilojoules here because we don't all have the same weight and we don't all have the same running economy or whatever economy of movement within something we're practicing. So slower runners maybe, right, are going to tend to take a little bit more energy, right? Longer, faster runners are going to tend to save a little bit more energy. And I think, but on an individual basis, right, when you're speeding up and slowing down and training or racing, especially if you're like an experienced expert runner in the sense that maybe you're not running a 210 marathon or a really strong 225 amateur marathon. But if you just have a high level of bodily kinesthetic intelligence in the sense of your training history and your movement fluency, I don't think you're really going to see much of an economy variation. So as you're decreasing your pace, right, your running economy is staying relatively constant. So it's still going to take you the same amount of kilojoules, I would argue, to run 6 miles at any given pace, plus, you know, within reason, right? Obviously, maybe if you have a drastic slowdown, or right, a drastic pace change, then maybe you're going to start to notice something, because maybe you're going to be getting out of, you know, a pattern of movement that you're, you know, you're really efficient with. But I think even if, right, running economy is variant across a range of paces for a given individual, well, the reality is it just means that you're going to, doesn't change the fact that there seems to be this outer barrier. And the reason why I say that it's a mechanical endurance is because that the kilojoule threshold is tied to mechanical endurance is because I don't see that as aligning with metabolic stuff. And I don't see that as aligning with, say, lactate threshold, because lactate threshold, the implication would be to say, well, if you're below lactate threshold, you're at this point of efficiency, you should be able to go indefinitely until glycogen depletion, but you're not really used, but maybe you're being, you know, so then you should be able to go even longer, right? But like, there's this other point of failure, right? That if you're not failing because you're, let's use simpler old school terms, if you're not failing because you're in oxygen debt, if you're not failing because you've run out of stored energy, you've run out of glucose, right? You've run out of stored glycogen, you'll still find failure. 2 years ago, I did three 50K runs, and one of them was an attempt at a 50K run in probably about 5 weeks. And the first one went out, got to about 18 miles, 20 miles, totally tied up, right? And I ended up basically having to stagger slash walk another 3 miles to where there was somebody who could pick me up in a car and just bring my carcass home. The next one, I went out and did the whole thing, but, you know, with the last 10 miles were a real grind. And then the third one, I ended up, you know, probably, I don't know, we averaged maybe 8:30 pace or something for the whole thing. But I ran the last 10 miles at under 8 minutes a mile, right? Which, you know, obviously in the scale of what people can do with running is maybe not that remarkable, but that's besides the point. The point is that transformation, right, across that time, right, is not a metabolic thing. That is not an improvement in lactate threshold. That's not an improvement in VO2 max. But something else is determinant to performance, and that's changing. And I think that is where we're seeing the change, that is this change in essentially kilojoule threshold, the capacity to handle and sustain mechanical work. Now, the most common motivation for endurance athletes in mass lies in the exhilarating kind of sensation of transcending our perceived limits. It's this levitating feeling of mastery over whatever that challenge is, whether that's running, cycling, swimming, skiing, or any other kind of power-driven, sustained individual activity, individual sport. These are the moments that kind of like push us out of a feeling of being ordinary into a feeling of kind of euphoria, right? The idea we've done something extraordinary, right? We feel validated, right? And that feeling of mastery really provides an immense sense of validation, purpose. You know, it's personally meaningful, right? It might not matter to anybody else, but we feel, we find that exhilarating on an individual level, right? And that basically is what performance really means writ large, right? But performance in endurance sports, racing, endurance racing sports, appears very simple because competitors set a velocity, right? And then they strive to maintain it throughout the event. aiming to increase their speed in the final stretch to cross the finish line ahead of their rivals. However, this simplicity is misleading because it doesn't give a window into the intricate training that and the planning and the pacing strategies and the physiological demands required to execute this effectively, right? So the simplicity is just an illusion. Performance is far more complex, right? It relies on an athlete's ability to understand, okay, what are my limits? What are my capabilities? And this involves associating oftentimes very subtle physical sensations with consequences that may not manifest until minutes, miles, or even hours later. And athletes must evaluate these sensations in real time and make informed decisions to adjust their efforts accordingly. So you're balancing immediate demands with long-term strategy. Okay. And in order to be able to do this effectively, we need to have a clear concept of what these boundaries are. Okay. So the development of that awareness and the calculation of what an athlete can and cannot execute successfully, okay, that is an outcome of that process of preparation. So if you have been put in a position to succeed, then you're going to be successful, right? And the kilojoule threshold, right, that's an example of putting yourself in a position to succeed. If you don't recognize that that is a barrier, essentially, to performance, then you're always going to be in a position of adversity. And when adversity is greater, the level of performance goes down, and then subjectively, culturally, we would say the probability of success goes down too. Okay, so preparation, i.e. training for endurance sports, has been largely siloed into this exercise physiology paradigm, wherein certain aspects of biological truth are determined, then athletes attempt to link those biological needs with specificity by engaging in training practices that they think specifically are going to target or elevate that. And so by doing it in this way, and you know, basically what we're saying is this becomes very complex and becomes very inaccessible very quickly because for people who lack the education or independent curiosity to build an understanding of physiology, whatever they're doing in terms of saying, okay, this is the physiological limit, I need to train that physiological limit is going to be an oversimplification. You know, even if VO2 max is true, I don't think that you actually improve VO2 max just by going out and just running intervals at supposed VO2 max intensity. Now, I know there's a lot of people out there who disagree with that. I am expressing the perspective that they are in the wrong in this instance. But regardless, this leaves us with an essentialist view that there's some sort of apex system or approach and that all training is basically reduced to that. And I think that's just too simple, and it's wrong. And maybe that's a product of cultural beliefs in the idea of this like holy grails of efficiency and optimization. Maybe that comes from some other place in the way in which we view the world. But the reality is that endurance sports training encompasses a multidimensional interplay of physiological, neuromuscular, and psychological factors, all operating within this framework, which is shaped by sociocultural norms and scientific understandings, and that milieu is the space in which training exists, because it is what people think and then do, because training is behavioral. Individuals, be it coaches or athletes, they make choices. These choices are influenced by a variety of factors, prior experience, cultural norms, available knowledge, and societal expectations. And then they attempt to translate their understandings of these choices into actions. For example, a coach might rely on anecdotal evidence or widely accepted practices to shape their athletes' routines, while an athlete might lean on personal trial and error or team culture to inform their decisions. And then these influences highlight, I believe, the interplay between learned behavior and these external pressures, and that interface, that interaction, determines training approaches, and then the training approaches then determine the outcomes. So whether training is done autonomously with a coach or within the context of a team, social behavior is the most fundamental underpinning of training, encompassing the influence of peers, coaches, team culture, and societal trends. For example, athletes often adopt training approaches that are popular within their immediate circles or align with widely accepted norms in their sport. Coaches play a pivotal role in shaping training behaviors through their philosophies, which may be influenced by mentorship, education, or professional networks. Additionally, societal trends such as the rise of high-intensity interval training or HIIT, or the popularity of endurance challenges like marathons and ultramarathons, further impact how individuals perceive and implement training strategies. This interconnected web of influences underscores that training is not an isolated practice, but a socially driven behavior shaped by collective and individual interactions. And this creates a kind of willful cognitive blindness, and I say willful in the sense that people aren't open to the idea that whatever our understandings are limited. And we're so focused on memorizing and sort of regurgitating and mimicking the things that we hear that we're just not asking questions, right? We're not really applying a process of inquiry to understanding this stuff. And the drive to understand the physiological whys behind training seemingly causes why training seemingly causes changes in performance has a long history. Early scientific efforts such as A.V. Hill's research on VO2 max in the 1920s, right? People see that as, okay, that's a groundwork for understanding the body's aerobic limits. This was followed by breakthroughs in lactate threshold research, right? And trying to understand how you transition, right, between aerobic and anaerobic energy systems, which in and of itself, I think we've talked about, is an example of a fallacy. So, right, you know, I'm summarizing this at the level of like what sort of the common perspective is, right? Not necessarily what I have suggested is the best possible understanding, okay? Or a principle like supercompensation, right? Says that, okay, recovery after training stress leads to improved performance, and then that codifies or creates this model for the relationship between load, fatigue, and adaptation to stress. So each of these, in their time, right, when they are new and novel, are seen as the answer to our training questions, okay? And, you know, now we see things where people, you know, biomechanics, sports nutrition, neuromuscular studies, right, people are saying this is expanding our understanding of how cumulative mechanical work and energy demands shape endurance performance, right? And so we have these evolving scientific narratives trying to bridge physiological theory with real-world practices. But confident statements about lactic acid, hydration, recovery, supercompensation, etc., lack the kind of absolute validation that we culturally seem to feel that they must have, and they miss the primary aspect that training is a performative social behavior. Understandings continue to evolve, as do the understandings of those understandings, which are reflected in the attempts to apply the science of training to the practice of training. And it doesn't mean that there are people who, there are coaches and there are scientists, and I know this is like a Steve Magnus thing, that these are these two, there's this duality, and they don't really like each other because of their differing in perspective. I just think that neither of them really necessarily have the answers that we think. Now, we also see that performance is a thing. We see that people seem to do well. We see that people say, I want to run well here, and then they do it. So performance is certainly a thing. And so people have practices that do this stuff. And I'm not saying that I know all the answers. The reality is nobody listens to me. Nobody applies any of the things that I suggest, right? This space is primarily, as for me, I have a need to work through these ideas, and this is a cool way for me to engage with my thinking about this. This podcast is a metacognitive exercise for me. I know that it doesn't move the needle for anybody else, but that's not the point, you know. And if you are listening and you find it thought-provoking and interesting, that's awesome. You know, it probably doesn't cause you to train differently in any way, shape, or form. And I think that just proves my point, right? That the factors that influence this are not based on, well, what is rational and sort of most effective from a sort of calculated, reasoned approach, that these decisions are coming from and influenced by other things. And in this way, right, the decision-making and action-taking are the central aspect of training. The majority of coaches and athletes engage in behaviors based on what is like a layperson's hearsay level of understanding. And this refers to a reliance on anecdotal advice, on verified practices, and popular misconceptions that oftentimes circulate heavily within athletic communities. For example, a coach might implement a high-intensity training method because it has been widely publicized as effective without considering whether it aligns with the physiological needs of their athletes. And then similarly, athletes might adopt hydration and recovery strategies because they've heard them repeated in training groups or online forums or on Instagram or whatever, and they're not asking themselves the question, like, is this valid, right? Where does this come from, right? Taking ice baths. Ice baths are stupid. They don't do anything. They're very popular, okay? People would rather be seen doing things that a cool, attractive person is doing than be seen doing things that are not what the cool, attractive people are doing, because then, gasp, that might mean that they are not cool and attractive. And those are the kinds of things that drive our decision-making. Those are priorities for a lot of us. And while these, you know, practices of coaches and athletes are common, they also highlight this critical gap between evidence-based knowledge and commonly accepted norms and training culture. Deep understanding is basically rare. And, you know, this extends to the conventional approach to writing books about training, which is to begin with a review of exercise physiology and then progress to training theory. Now, this makes sense when the rationalization of training theory is rooted in the physiological precepts that the author holds to be true, but there's a limitation to this approach. When everything is rationalized against the current model of physiology, then it becomes impossible to argue for training practices when they strongly correlate with performance and practice, but the physiological mechanism is unclear. Because now you can't validate these, because the standard isn't, hey, here are things that we see happening, how can we explain them? It's to say, here are the things that are true, and if we can't link it to a physiological mechanism, then we can't talk about it. Okay, so you're getting an obfuscation. Now, it's not this, I mean, you should be able to prove things, right? But training also should be a forum where we're talking about ideas and practices, and that should be encouraged. Okay, it's not a unethical practice to say, for as we're saying in this episode, to say, you know what, it looks like there might be a kilojoule threshold that proves that there is a mechanical endurance limiter with any particular domain. And then to say, well, what does that line up with? And like, here's another example. You can be in great shape running, great shape cycling. You flip to the other one and you're a mess. Okay, you're a mess. And even if you do both of them at the same time, if you, right, don't specifically work at those higher kilojoule capacities, then you're just not going to have the endurance within each particular domain, even if you're doing these things overall. And I think this is where a lot of triathletes probably find themselves up a creek without the paddle, is that they do spend time and they work on three different sports to bring it together into one sport of triathlon, and it's just not necessarily translating the way that they would want to see that. Okay, and I think, how do we explain that? Well, I think the theory of mechanical endurance, KJ threshold, kilojoule threshold, I think speaks to that.
So essentially, the limitation that we have when we're talking about making the physiological driven rationalization for training practices is that the assumption is implicit that A, the understanding of the physiological mechanisms is absolute, and that there is no additional understanding waiting to be unearthed or be discovered. And I'm not, obviously, there's nothing wrong with speculating. That's sort of the name of the game with athletic training, is to trying to make inferences, make assumptions, see where those lead you. But if the physiology does not rationalize a practice, but a practice has a very strong correlation, then that certainly implies that there's some causation going on, especially if, you know, you can demonstrate that overwhelmingly when a given practice is not present, you do not see the same performance outcome as when it is present. But if you can't explain that with the physiology as we currently understand it, then that to me must imply that there's an additional not understood mechanism at play, and that we should be making the inference that there must be something else here. And then those of us who have the means to do so, right, should be trying to think about how can we research our way to that point of that understanding. So progress in training theory and practice in training is going to be driven by people's willingness to try different practices and then look for the implied mechanisms that have not been clearly identified, or to take that data and then reevaluate the mechanisms of training, right? Do we not understand the physiology correctly? And I think what's difficult about this is a lot of our models of knowledge and learning are rooted in this idea of somebody will disseminate to you, these are the truths, your academic proficiency is largely how well can you understand these truths. And I think what should be happening is that we should have enough understanding of the realities of information, in a sense, the way the information landscape has changed, that it's not a good use of time in learning to just be trying to, well, you need to retain as many facts as you can, because unless you carry your set of Encyclopedia Britannicas with you everywhere you go, you're not going to have access to information by which to like make meaning out of things around you, you know. So right, you understand that in a information-free environment, so to speak, that it's the information you have with you that's going to have a big impact. We don't live in an environment like that anymore, and that's why we should be seeing more growth in these areas. You know, and conversely, right, I think that we, or maybe not conversely, is not the word we're looking for here. Ironically, it seems to be the opposite, that it's given people more access to information that they evaluate uncritically or unquestioningly and apply that like rote memorization where you hear people repeating things. And this is one of the challenges or downside to social media influencer coaches, whatever they try to present themselves as, is if your level of understanding is proficient enough, you look at these people and hear what they're saying, and this doesn't make any sense. So let's give an example of kind of the scale or the limit of this reasoning. So a common practice of high school cross-country coaches across the United States is to have athletes complete workouts totaling 3 miles, right? So we can think metrically, right? The metric mile is 1,600 meters, so 4,800 meters, right? Or maybe 5,000 meters. But for all intents and purposes, plus or minus 3 miles, plus or minus 5,000 meters, right? Plus or minus maybe 200 meters either way, okay? And that's broken into work intervals and recovery intervals. Coaches might start with 12 by 400 meters, then progress to 6 by 800, and then 3 by 1,600 meter over the course of the season. And some coaches who are feeling clever might add in an all-out 200-meter interval in each workout as a bonus repetition to simulate the finish of the 5,000-meter cross-country race. The basic logic here is that as the season progresses, the athletes are increasing in their ability to sustain the pace they train at because they are increasing the duration of the time spent running that pace before reaching a rest interval, right? Going from quarter-mile repeats to 800-meter repeats to 1,600-meter repeats, right? So there's a simple logic to that. Okay, so that's where somebody, a rationalization process determines what people think is important. Now, alternatively, other coaches might do something that is literally the inversion. They might progress in the alternate direction. They might start with 3 by 1600, then move to 6 by 800, and then end up with 12 by 400. In this model, coaches might start the paces slower with the longer repetitions, and then shorten the intervals as the season progressed with the idea that it would then increase speed. Now, the problem is with this stuff is it's applying a certain limited concept right here, which is this, there's this fixed quantity of velocity, right? And I think in this context, you know, a lot of coaches maybe try to rationalize this and say, oh, well, this is VO2 max training. I'm improving, or we're improving the athlete's VO2 max. But if you give this training to a group of 10 to 50 athletes, you're likely to see some of them improve. And if you have a bunch of athletes who, you know, if you don't work them to the point of injury, and they don't have much training history, they're going to be able to perform better over the course of the season. And then you can rationalize a lack of comparable improvement across the scale of the athlete pool to who is talented and who isn't talented. So it's easy for coaches to validate any given model of training because, and then assume, well, this is how athletes get better. It's almost like they're shocked of, wow, I applied exercise to a group of non-exercising people and they showed improvement. I've really figured out this running thing. But training isn't about creating any level of improvement and saying, hey, I did it. Awesome. Right? I'm going to write a book. Training is about recognizing that, you know, against baseline of non-activity, pretty much any level of physical activity is going to lead to improvement. So real training strategy is about opportunity cost. How can you find the most efficient model of doing this, right? And so their model is basically, well, if we do things that are challenging and fatiguing, the scale of challenge and fatigue is proportional to the return, right? But what I would say is that what you want is you want to get stimulus but avoid getting fatigue as much as possible. I think that's where the value is. But when you look at your group of cross-country athletes and you just dismiss outliers on the basis of a lack of talent, a lack of willpower, being, you know, susceptible to injury, these other sort of artificial social constructs of perception of performance, you are, you know, just first of all, you're reducing the cognitive load to you as the coach, where you don't have to think about what you're doing, right? And let's be honest, a lot of coaches are not thinkers, okay? That's not how they approach this stuff. They're passionate about the sport. They're passionate about being a coach. They're passionate about that role and that influence, and they like the status of being a coach, and that can be very exciting for folks in some cases. But they're not necessarily really thinking about this stuff, right? And so rationalizations of, well, who's talented, who's not, who's injury susceptible, who's not, that basically means you don't have to think about what you're doing. And it can be very exciting in any field to feel like you've in a position where you can apply an idea and see that work. That's an experience that is fundamentally motivating because we feel like we're moving towards, you know, autonomy, purpose, mastery. Coaching is very addictive culturally because it's an avenue for you to do those things. And in most people in there, we don't have an outlet for that, right? Either personally, right? We don't have personal hobbies or interests where we're pursuing that, and or professionally, we're not in a position to try out any of our ideas. So conversely, right, to this kind of brick by brick approach of, well, let's take 5,000 meters and let's break down that intensity into intervals, and then we can rationalize that by VO2 max. And I think for a lot of people, just getting to that framework of perception is like a big leap in understanding. And I don't know why that's so challenging, right? But I think think about tying your shoes, right? At some point, tying your shoes probably reduced you to tears, and you don't even remember what it was like learning to do that anymore, right? So just because something is initially complicated doesn't mean that once you've mastered it, that there's no place for additional growth. When I was coaching cross country, we didn't apply this kind of a model. So examples of sessions that we did included 20 by 200 meters with 200 meter recovery, running the repetitions faster than race pace, but, you know, accumulating less than 5,000 meters of quote, quote, work. But the whole running session that day might be 11 or 12 miles between the recovery and the other warming up and cooling down and whatever, right? So thinking about like a different concept of what are we trying to accomplish. Another session would be three sets of five by half mile with 400 meter recovery, right? And running that slower than race pace. And, but there you have way more than 5,000 meters of work. Plus, again, probably 11 to maybe even as much as 14 miles, depending on how much, you know, warming up and cooling down. We would do a 20-minute very slow jog in between each set, for example, right? Which is adding more work, right? Of a different nature, right? So we're not only thinking about, well, what is the supposed specific physiological demand of 5,000 meter cross country running? How can we practice that in the form of intervals? And then another session we would do would be to run a 4,000 meters at threshold, right? Which is much slower than race pace. 7 mile run, and then 6x200 meter with the 200 intervals much faster than race pace, right? So again, very dissimilar to this kind of concept. And when we think about this, right, there's several important ways in which these workouts differ from the original high school cross country approach outlined above. And, you know, to be clear, I am saying that I think that this is an example of moving to a more sophisticated approach, and how when you change the way you think about this stuff, it doesn't just change your explanation for why the workouts you want to do are best. It changes your explanation of what is effective. And so then you do different things, looking for things that are more effective. So first, these workouts are not designed to sequence into one another, right? So with this other model, the idea is that as people go across the scale of the cross-country season, that they are, in a sense, like, okay, this session feeds into this session, feeds into this session, right? And one of the things coaches will then do is, because blaming athletes is a predominant practice of coaches, which is obviously hysterical at the high school level because it's adults blaming teenagers, although culturally, you know, I don't put that totally on the coaches. Culturally, we really endorse the idea of people with vastly greater life experience blaming people with less than 2 decades of life experience, blaming those people for all of the problems, right? Which is another way of, again, voiding responsibility as, you know, coaches or adults, or just voiding responsibility as the person who, you know, by virtue of experience, you have a responsibility to apply that experience and knowledge in a meaningful way. So for us, right, we're not saying, oh, well, you missed this one workout, so now you broke the sequence and that's why it isn't working, right? If they're missing workouts in the first place, that's probably indicative of the fact that training already isn't working, okay? So for us, when we were applying these workouts, we're thinking about how can the training be designed to engender improvement through adaptation. And the training load, which as Jack Daniels, who I don't agree with everything that Jack Daniels emphasizes, but here's an example of somebody who holds some conflicting viewpoints, and I, you know, agree, right? There's some commonality here. As he emphasized, you don't need to increase the training load or the training intensity, or that combination of intensity plus load, which equals, you know, the work that you're doing effectively, until performance has plateaued. So that's one piece of it. Secondly, these workouts do not focus on maximizing stress on any given threshold that is supposedly limiting of a potential performance. Whereas many coaches might identify VO2 max as determinant of performance and then try to train athletes at that intensity, these workouts are designed around the threshold of proximal development. So unlike a purely physiological hypothesized determinant of performance, proximal development is different. Proximal development is making space for the way in which the brain, which is present and has to be considered, because the brain does not turn off as much as people, though this is another piece, is right, trying to encourage people mind over matter, which is kind of actually an inverted way of like saying, like, use your consciousness to ignore the other parts of your consciousness or unconsciousness so that you can create meaningful and worthy performance. Proximal development is the idea is that when we get to the boundary of our competence and our skill level, that's where we get the most improvement. And when we go beyond that boundary, now things become less effective. So again, when we set a different determining value point for performance, then we're going to determine different possible strategies and approaches to training, and certain things that might have made sense before aren't going to make sense anymore. Third, the intention was always to train in aggregate, rather than see each workout as a progression from the previous session. The composition of work creates a quilt where individual squares and the pattern are significant for their contribution to the whole, not just for their relationship to the adjacent square, and that these workouts sought to engage the proximal zone, if you will, for speed and for endurance and for stamina and for lactate threshold and strength, etc. Right? So the idea is that there are these limiters out there that are physiological, but because performance engages the brain, as has been well articulated by Tim Noakes' central governor theory, the using workouts, right, to train. And a workout could really be anytime you're out exercising, that's a workout, to be clear. It's not just the challenging day with intervals. That workouts have to allow for the role of that mechanism. Because even if you don't want to, if you say, well, I don't know if I believe in that, that doesn't matter because it's present. The brain is present. And you can choose to acknowledge the role and the relationship of the brain to exercise or not. But it's still going to be there. And that mechanism is also determinant to performance. So when you say there's any physiological capacity, the existence of that capacity, the threshold failure point or exhaustion point of that capacity, and the improvement of that capacity is related to the brain and the way the brain regulates performance, regulates exercise, regulates anything we do. So rather than try to overwhelm the mind's role in performance, we try to basically accept that the brain helps set thresholds to determine performance, and that that's actually, there's a reason for that, that that's more effective and better, right? We think about the concept of pacing. You can't really pace effectively if you don't have feelings of stress. And it's important to emphasize this point, that the brain does not require specific brain training to be engaged. Rather, all training inherently involves the brain, just as it involves every other part of the body. So the objective here is to elucidate that the likely mechanisms through which this occurs, right, when you're thinking about the training, and to leverage that understanding to argue that training velocities, right, or training force application, if you think in terms of watts, should be finding an alignment with zones of proximal development, right? And our brain is not a barrier to performance, but an enabler of performance. Pain and discomfort, rather than being obstacles, are essential tools that maximize performance by helping us identify and expand the boundaries of what is possible for us as athletes.
So if there is a central concept that distinguishes effective structured training from ineffective haphazard training, it is the ability to anticipate and manage fatigue. Arthur Lydiard, for instance, reflected on his early experiences with interval training, noting that the intensity of that training often left athletes too fatigued to follow planned sessions consistently. This inconsistency undermined their capacity to trigger the meaningful epigenetic responses, which are essential for driving the physiological adaptations that lead to performance improvement. And as a result, athletes found themselves essentially unable to progress due to the lack of an ability to engage in sustained and structured training necessary to engender development over a longer period of time that meaningfully improves performance beyond just a standard variation. And most of us at any level of these endurance aerobically driven sports, that's really where we're hovering, is we are sort of have some vacillation around a median performance point
And we pretend that our training is determining that, but it's really not making the difference that we think it is. So clearly he decided that being able to train according to a schedule was more important than training according to a given intensity. So therefore, he inverted the hierarchy of importance to put intensity as subservient to the demands of the schedule. Most athletes and coaches still give focus and attention to intensity first, though. That's the norm. And there's a great deal of anxiety among endurance athletes that they aren't training hard enough or fast enough to improve. And I think that's one of the things that drives the choice making in that capacity. Now, of course, any training that improves performance is changing the physiology of the body to the extent that the capacities of those underlying mechanisms allow performance to improve. And the sociological aspects of a driven narrative, I think, is what's demonstrating how the reason why it's difficult to apply things that have been established, you know, in excess of 50 years ago, is because of how much societal forces influence the dissemination and acceptance of training methodologies. Through a kind of like a filtering effect, society selectively amplifies certain ideas, and that allows them to gain traction in popular consciousness while marginalizing other approaches, right? We could call these alternative approaches, not alternative as in they're ineffective or stupid, but just alternative as they're other than the amplified. And as a result, the most commonly discussed training practices are often perceived as the best practices, irrespective of their empirical or practitioner validity. And this leads to an acceptance bias where individuals disproportionately rely on these familiar concepts, where the goal is to just try to remember things and not get to deeper understanding. And, you know, you look for the compounding nature of this issue to explain it in the context of things like the Dunning-Kruger effect, wherein individuals with limited expertise mistakenly perceive themselves as knowledgeable, creating a widespread but very superficial understanding of endurance training. And this dynamic fosters a culture where nuanced and evidence-based approaches are often essentially overshadowed by these oversimplified narrative structures to training, right? Training isn't narrative, but people find narrative storytelling engaging and comprehensible. And so people are taking on the things that engage their understanding, not that engage what is most effective. So traditional endurance training, right, focuses on metabolic adaptations, particularly focused around these thresholds like lactate threshold or kind of the VO2 max is a kind of a threshold, and that those are enhancing performance. However, there's also, right, evidence that says that other factors, right, like muscular fatigue, and for lack of a better term, I'm going to say neuromuscular as proxy for the concept that I'm talking about with sort of this kilojoule threshold of mechanical fatigue. But, you know, I acknowledge that there's a more specific probably application of neuromuscular fatigue that is other than how I'm using it, right? But I'm looking for placeholder vocabulary to touch back to the concept and not have to go into 150 words of reference every time we want to refer to that. So here we're going to say neuromuscular fatigue is defined by cumulative mechanical work or kilojoule expenditure as a determinant of endurance capacity. And adaptation and epigenetic responses influenced by the pressure of natural selection, okay, are fundamentally designed to maximize the body's performance. And performance in this context is defined as balancing physiological and energetic costs to ensure survival and reproduction, right? So we're not talking about sports performance, we're talking about organism performance. And organisms that efficiently acquire energy for self-maintenance are more likely to thrive and reproduce, highlighting efficiency as a cornerstone of adaptation. This implies that all adaptations occur as a result of homeostatic disruption, which is the body's response to a, or the effect of, right, a persistent imbalance between energy demand and supply. We might consider that a homeostatic disruption. For example, the chronic energy needs, that demand will signal the need for physiological changes such as increased strength. And that's going to shift, create shifts in metabolic energy from anaerobic to aerobic pathways. And then enhancements in mechanical endurance are happening as well in order for this to be sufficiently effective. And this adaptation is a proof of the body's response to repeated stress being to improve efficiency. Okay. And, you know, pain and discomfort, right, are there in this context. We can understand these that fits also with this because they discourage excessive energy expenditure and try to make us, encourage us to make determinations about how essential is the function of energy consumption that we're performing. And that's why under conditions of fear, anger, or other things we might define as necessity, hormones like adrenaline and cortisol and these effects we know can override these inhibitory mechanisms, allowing individuals to sustain effort despite that discomfort or to not necessarily perceive discomfort at the same way. And when the energy demand is chronic and consistently exceeds the body's current capacity, well, then the most efficient thing is to create adaptations instead of using hormone compensation. And hormones aren't going to take a 5-minute miler and turn them into a 4-minute miler by scaring the crap out of them, right? That's not the capacity of that. It's just a capacity to like extend performance, right? But you're not going to fundamentally go to a different level because these, and we're not saying these metabolic factors aren't there, they are still there, right? But we're saying that this is not a sufficiently holistic understanding of what's going on. And so the very existence of adaptation is proof of chronic demand. In principle, adaptation arises solely in response to the need to be able to sustain and engage with a chronic demand. And this understanding is the basis of trying to make better meaning of modern endurance training, as many athletes and coaches are equating improvements in fitness with constant high-intensity effort. And this misinterpretation often is leading to burnout, frustration, stagnation. And if instead the training can aim to elicit a balanced response, where the thought process is, okay, can we recognize the points of maximum benefit and the thresholds beyond which returns start to diminish? And by adopting kind of like an evidence-based approach to adaptive strategies, athletes are going to be able to achieve sustainable performance improvements without compromising long-term health. And what we've tried to do here is synthesize from these perspectives to propose a more comprehensive training paradigm that integrates physiological markers, perceived exertion, and we're going to talk a lot more about perceived exertion in upcoming episodes, and these kilojoule threshold type metrics. So an encapsulating thought here to wrap up this discussion within the context of this episode is that when we think about the idea of mechanical energy and this idea of a kilojoule threshold, it means that just eating, right, isn't enough to sustain exercise, right? So there's other things at play beyond metabolic, a metabolic cycle of input output. And, you know, that's rooted in the brain, but not in the consciousness as willpower part of the brain, but in all of these other functions of the brain wherein it's determining performance. And when we think about training and we think about this concept, what we want to be trying to do is we want to think about how can I get the best exchange rate between improvement, stimulus of adaptation, and fatigue, where we are buying that with fatigue, but we want the best value on that. We want to spend, or in more specifically, as is true, is we want to accrue the least amount of fatigue possible to reach the most value of benefit that we can. And this is very different from a traditional concept of let's maximize fatigue. And this is why approaches where people maximize
exhaustion and failure, you know, in terms of like training to failure, are not very effective. And it's because you are just, you're maximizing fatigue. You're getting very low to potentially negative return on your investment. And when we start to think about this concept of a kilojoule threshold, of this idea that energy expenditure is clearly implicitly must be functioning in a particular way, and that means that we need to explore further is, what does that look like? Why is that a grounded inference? And what is the implication of how to think about this stuff differently, and how does it interplay with other systems of fatigue? Thanks for listening to today's episode. If you've enjoyed this episode, you can check out any number of our other episodes on the podcast page, wherever you find it. And if you have questions or content that you'd like to see us address, you can send us a message on our Instagram page at BlackCatsRun, or send us an email to BlackCatsRunPod@gmail.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time.